From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, the battle over the hearts and minds of young Texans by controlling what's in their textbooks. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. In 2018, the 15-member Texas State Board of Education voted to streamline the social studies curriculum they kept in that Moses informed the American founding documents and that the defenders of the Alamo were, quote, heroic, and they cut out Hillary Clinton and Helen Keller. It was just another skirmish in the ongoing battle over what to teach in Texas classrooms. And again, the decision-making process was more about politics than actual education. It was in 1917 that Texas law first authorized the state board to purchase textbooks for all of the schools. And that's when a small group of people were able to make big decisions over what young Texans were told about their state. And that group of people has long been influenced by conservative activism. In the early 1920s, the Ku Klux Klan influenced the state board to forbid references to evolution in Texas textbooks. It was during the Cold War that Texas conservatives were able to flex big in education debates. The Daughters of the American Revolution, the John Birch Society, and Texans for America used the Red Scare and paranoia over communism to censor or diminish fact-based evidence in history textbooks, taking aim at labor unions, Social Security, the New Deal, the United Nations, racial integration, and the Supreme Court. Historian Alan O. Counselor's own history textbooks were the subject of conservative attacks. Now he writes about that history of the tug of war over truth in the book, The Great Texas Social Studies Textbook War of 1961-1962. He says the extent of the protest and the snowballing from one issue to another made this one of the most lengthy and controversial textbook battles in American history.
Controversy was over the content, primarily of what was in American history textbooks for grade 8 and grade high school level. Well, the problem was, one of the problems, with the changing of the guard in historiography by World War II and after World War II, you've got a new group of scholars coming out writing history, and they're incorporating more than just the very famous men in Texas history. And you've got minority groups by 1960 protesting about wanting more say in textbooks, like African Americans, like Hispanic Americans, women's groups. You get all of these groups coming into this new American historiography, and it changes everything. The Civil Rights Movement, the introduction of all the programs from the Roosevelt's New Deal, Harry Truman's Fair Deal, and all these things are coming into play, and Texas was just right on the verge of being expanded anyway with textbooks because of the Gilmer Smith and Gilbert Aiken textbook law, which provided for a better organized way to for Texas to adopt textbooks for the public schools. And it set up a state textbook committee with a commissioner of education, and the commissioner would appoint the members of the state textbook committee. And each year, the teachers on that textbook committee had to be teachers in those areas up for adoption. And so things changed drastically. And then all of a sudden, 1960 and 61, 62, you've got the, they call for a new American history textbooks. And it led to protest about those textbooks from some conservative groups, such as Texans for America and the Daughters of the American Revolution. They protested a number of those textbooks that came up for adoption in Texas. And the State Textbook Committee, in spite of that, adopted 15 books for each subject area. The Texans for America had protested all 15. Daughters of the American Revolution protested all 15 of their books up for adoption. So the State Textbook Committee approved those textbooks, and then the State Board of Education approved that recommendation. And it infuriated the Texans for America, people representing the Daughters of the American Revolution. So they persuaded the Texas legislature to hold a series of hearings, public hearings, on the content of history textbooks. And the Speaker of the House appointed a 5-member group to evaluate those textbooks, and they held 7 public hearings around the state with 124 witnesses. And it exploded into just one thing after another. And with the previous ruling for the textbooks, you could only protest a book. You couldn't offer support for it. And so by going public in the public hearings, 5 members invited anyone who wanted to come testify to do so. So as a result, you had the Texas for America on one side with remnants of the Minute Women and the John Birch Society. And on the other side, the more liberal groups, you had representatives, the Texas Institute of Letters, various University of Texas professors in the humanities, Texas Council for the Social Studies, the Texas Library Association, Mari Maverick of the American Civil Liberties Union. You had the major conservative groups and the major liberal groups come out either against those textbooks or for them in all these public hearings. One thing evolved into another, and the thing just expanded like crazy. You'd get one issue pretty well resolved, and then another one would crop up as a result of that. So even library books became targets, and you had authors like J. Frank Dovey, John Steinbeck, Thomas Wolfe, George Orwell, Pearl S. Buck, McKinley Cantor, Ernest Hemingway, Stephen Benet, Maxwell Anderson, Albert Einstein, Willa Cather, Jack London, Aaron Copland, William Faulkner, Carl Sandburg, Ida Tarbell, Lincoln Steffens. Do you see what I mean? Books by those authors were being pulled from libraries, like in Amarillo and in Midland, and so students couldn't read them because the conservatives said they were subversive. It's expanded into a civil suit for slander against one of the members of the state legislature. It expanded into legislative wrongdoing by 2 members of the legislature accusing one another of defrauding the state government. And finally, by 1961 and 62, the legislature was asked if it wanted to continue the investigation of those textbooks, and they said no, absolutely not, and they stopped it. But in the process, they had the whole lot of all the hearings with the pros and the cons. It set up a system, a precedent for evaluating textbooks that the state finally adopted, where you could say something good about a textbook or something bad about a textbook. And so what I did, I went back and looked at all those hearings, and I thought, my gosh, this is something else. Because the arguments put forth by the liberals and the conservatives were as relevant then, today, as they were then. They're classic arguments for and against what should be in a social studies textbook. The arguments are beautifully phrased by people who gave it some thought and articulated all this. And so I went back and looked at the legislative hearings on all this, the recordings, the transcripts, the newspaper articles, and every book I'd find to read about it. And I thought, so that's where all this began. And it came to fruition with the 2010 social studies standards adopted by a conservative state board of education. They created another new furor. And so you get a series of books coming out about those 2010 social studies standards. And so I thought, how did all this begin? It began with those textbook protests in 61, 62. It is the ancestor of all the following textbook protests that have occurred in Texas. I'm just talking about Texas, not the country. But the Texas one of 61, 62 was also one as widespread as any of the others in American history, whether it be Michigan, New York, California. So it's a classic.
Texas, though, had a outsized role to play in the selection of and the creation of textbooks throughout the country, though.
Yes, because Texas adopts so many textbooks that it's where the publishers want to do well in Texas. If you do well in Texas, you're going to do well elsewhere. That was another reason. By 1961, the new textbook process through the Gilmer-Aiken Bill had just become to maturity, and it was ripe. It was ready for any kind of protest. And the legislature, by providing for that pro and con, provided a background and a basis for all the later protests to occur. And the Board of Education finally amended that process so that during the process, the textbook process selection, you could be for or against a textbook, not just against. So you had all these. So as a result, over the years, all of these various groups have become prominent in either protesting or supporting a textbook program.
You mentioned the Minute Women, and they're looking at libraries and what they put on the shelves. And in the book, you talk a little bit about what happened in San Antonio. Mayor Jack White's wife looking at the books that are stocked, that were stocked in the library. And in the city council meeting, we had the city manager saying we should just take all those books and burn them.
You had, like in San Antonio, like Maury Maverick Sr., who came out against this book banning. Very, very vocal about it. And then a lot of liberal groups joined that. So what it did, 61, 62, those protests, for and against, set a pattern for both types of groups to come out and protest. And the protests began to vary according to what the social, political, economic conditions were at the time in Texas, as well as around the country. And as I was putting this together, I thought, my gosh, this is like a novel. It just goes from one chapter to the next, about one issue to the next issue to the next issue. It's like a story that sort of unfolds and finally ended up the way it is today.
What were the issues? What was so awful about these textbooks that needed to be they needed to protect our tender youth from?
Okay, they needed to protect, according to the conservatives, they needed to protect us from the New Deal, the Fair Deal, the United Nations, anything that looked wasn't pro-American, quote unquote. They needed to protect us because of the uniqueness of American history, the uniqueness of the American government, and what they didn't want was a lot of emphasis on minority rights and federal rights. It was basically a reaction to what had been occurring since the 1930s, politically.
How did integration of our schools play into this?
Hugely. The civil rights groups varied, but mainly they were the African American, the Hispanic, and then eventually the gay groups got involved. And then today, they're even talking about climate change and that sort of thing. So it's against big business.
So when you tell a narrative about the growth of conservative movements looking at these issues, and frequently their concerns are very much along the lines of protecting the white interest in communities and in schools, maintaining Jim Crow, and then also maintaining the values of the great Southern Lost Cause of the Civil War.
Yeah.
There's a lot of that in here in regards to the history that wants to be told, that they wanted told.
Yes. Yeah, I include. And what I did, I looked at both sides, and I've had six social studies textbooks adopted by the state of Texas. After I got my history degrees in the Northeast, I came back to Texas and received a teaching job at Trinity University, and In my spare time, I was asked by the publishers to start writing some of these new point-counterpoint, inquiry-oriented social studies textbooks, which I did with myself sometimes and occasionally with a co-author. And all six of my books were adopted over the years from 1971 all the way up to 1990 by the State Textbook Committee and by the Commissioner of Education. And in the process, I received protest from the conservative groups and the liberal groups, both of the same book. And I would go to Austin and defend the book before the State Textbook Committee or defend it before the State Board of Education. And in the process, I encountered Mel and Norma Gabler, who I devoted a whole chapter to in this book. And they did not protest anything I'd done in 61, but that was the first time the Gablers appeared on the scene.
Sure. And so let me just hit pause for a second. So Mel and Norma Gabler of Longview, they were declared in 1980 two of the most powerful people in education in America.
Yes.
They were profiled on 60 Minutes.
Yes.
They were running out of their home in Longview, an operation that was basically scrubbing every textbook proposed in Texas and therefore through America, looking for anything that they thought was not in the best interest of their political views.
Yes, true. And I had to debate them six times before the State Textbook Committee and six times before the State Board of Education. Fortunately, I never changed anything except for one photograph. I had a painting by Theodore Gentise of a woman grinding corn in San Antonio in the 1700s, and they said it was pornographic because if you took a magnifying glass, you could see part of the women's breast. And I had another painting by him I substituted just in a minute, and that was the only one. But I became very well acquainted with Mel and Norma Gabler.
Now, they portrayed themselves as just a couple of common folk from Longview. She was a homemaker, and he was from Exxon. He was a clerk or something.
Yes.
And and they were just took this on as sort of a hobby cause. Is that true?
Yes, it was a hobby. They had a son who, when he got into junior high, brought home a textbook, history textbook, not mine, thank goodness. And they didn't like what they saw in it about the New Deal, and they protested it. And then by this 1961, 62, they entered the textbook protest movement on a large scale by being one of the speakers at that legislative hearing, and they spoke out forcefully against every book that was up for adoption in 61, 62, and that's how they got their start. And they were very successful in some cases, in other cases they weren't.
But they were so good, so skilled. You know, you would hear Norma Gabler give her, say, all we want is the best for our children. And if Texas is going to be spending all of this money for school books, let's just make sure that they are the best. And and that was their code for what?
Well, I never agreed with them. But what I did like was they were so consistent. They never deviated from their basic approach. Basically, it was pro, quote, unquote, American. In other words, don't say anything negative in American history, about American history.
We still hear that today. We still hear that today when they say these textbooks are not portraying the appropriate American or Texas exceptionalism as if that were actually a thing.
Yes, I know it. And they're still going on today. All this from the 61-62 hearings and all these protests, all of that is as relevant today as it was back then. Every bit of it.
So
include the Gablers and all that group.
Now, evolution,
Yeah, it's still the same. They were creationists.
So they wanted to have a young Earth story told in the textbooks, and that if you were going to put in the textbook about how the geological history of the planet that took, you know, billions and billions and billions of years, then you should balance that with the sudden creation theory, with the sudden creation belief.
They protested one of my world history books as saying that I had an error because I had a civilization that existed, I said, prior to 4004 B.C. And I said, yes, I do, because it did exist. And I said, you're going to have to go back and study carbon dating, carbon-14 dating. And that's how these dates are. And I asked them if they had read anything by Charles Darwin, and they hadn't. And I said, well, okay. So I have a huge section of the book on Gablers and creationism.
So in 1970, it was required that textbooks in Texas listed evolution as a theory and not a fact.
Yeah, and what I did in the book, I talked about what scientists mean by theory. It's different than just a guess. It's based on evidence, on scientific evidence.
Why so much importance put on textbooks? Why was this where all of the energy was focused?
It started with J. Evans Haley, who was a first-rate historian until he wrote a text and looks at Lyndon, and that wrecked his career because it was really faulty, faulty history. If I had a student writing something like that, I'd give him an F. But what they did, he ran for governor in the 50s and lost badly. Then he ran for commissioner of agriculture, and he lost. So he and a group formed Texans for America, and the idea was, we can't win in politics, but we can win in the schoolroom. And so let's go after the textbooks, which they did. And they were very, very articulate about what they did and how they did it. And I was impressed.
The other side of the coin is J. Frank Dobie?
You bet. And he came right at them. And not only Dobie, but Lon Tinkle, Frank Wardlaw, all kinds of very, very prominent scholars jumped in on this thing. And so you had all of these distinguished scholars on one side, the liberal side, and then you had J. Frank Dobie, and you had J. Evans Haley, you had the Gablers, and you had even General Edwin Walker, the right-wing military leader who Kennedy finally fired. Who opposed integration of anything, racial integration. And so they got their start. And in Texas, by that time, it had put together and matured enough as far as its textbook selection process that it had become a leader in the country in the adoption of textbooks. And so they went for the textbooks, the social studies textbooks.
So did we have historians versus historians, and were they on equal footing? And
yes.
And so were they claiming different facts or just trying to say which facts are more important than others?
The problem was you had historians versus – J. Evans Haley was a historian, and he went after Paul Bowler's book, who was a professor at Southern Methodist University. And this is 61, 62, and Haley really went after that book, and Bowler wasn't used to the way Texas politics operates, and he thought it would be like, you know, a discussion on the pros and cons of the New Deal. Well, that's not the way it works. It's pretty rough and tumble, and Daley began to just eat him up, eat Bowler up. So Bowler responded forcefully with his own book, and that was published by Southern Methodist University Press recently, and gave him a tit for tat, same thing. But those were the only time you had an accomplished previously accomplished scholar like Haley take on a reputable historian. And then Haley, when he published A Texan Looks at Lyndon, destroyed his own reputation. And from then on, you didn't have any professional historians operating from the conservative viewpoint, not of any particular statue, but you did on the liberal side.
Now, this is all happening during the Red Scare of the 1950s and 60s.
The middle of the Red Scare coming down. And you had the Soviet Union, China, you had Vietnam, all these places going communist, really communist. And at the same time, you had a number of Texas politicians that were becoming more liberal. And you had, of course, Lyndon Johnson, who was turning more and more liberal. But you had Ralph Yarborough as a United States senator, who's about as liberal as you could get. And in the process, John F. Kennedy gets elected president in 61. And that did it with the conservatives. They thought, we've got to move now. And so they did. And they did it by attacking the textbooks.
So the textbooks were a favorite target because they wanted to create a new generation that would not be favorable, would not look at the New Deal as favorable. And how do they do that? So they decide, don't put good things about the New Deal in the book.
Or the United Nations, like the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It was that sort of thing. And it was pretty extensive.
And so also the civil rights. So they saw a crossover between the communism and pro-civil rights.
Yes, which a lot of people did. And then that's what they looked for in the textbooks. And in the meantime, you've got the civil rights groups wanting more about their own problems in the textbooks.
They wanted diversity in the textbooks.
This is prior to all the civil rights acts of the 1960s. And but Lyndon Johnson was already working toward that, and so was Kennedy. They knew it was coming. They wanted to act while they could. And Texas was adopting social studies textbooks about every 10 years. And so this would give them a chance to get a textbook into the schools that would probably be there for at least 9 or 10 or maybe 10 years.
So when they are accusing, say, like this Texans for America, when they're accusing the other side of indoctrinating young minds, that's actually what they wanted to do.
Yes, exactly.
Now, so who won? Who won the Great War of the textbooks?
I know from some experience, for the most part, up until probably 2010, the liberals on the state textbook committee usually won, and with the State Board of Education, but not without a huge fight, My books were adopted, but not without a fight. It was brutal sometimes.
They accuse you of, being a secular humanist?
You name it. And I'm not.
Alan O. Counselor is a historian and the author of The Great Texas Social Studies Textbook War of 1961-1962. It recounts how Texas became the national battleground over what teachers could teach and what students could learn. It's published by Texas A&M University Press. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You could also write directly on our show page at tpr.org. That's where you can listen to past Texas Matters programs, and you can find us wherever you download your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.